It was a bone construct. She could tell that much. Gray Tendon strapped a dozen weirdly malformed humeri to horribly abbreviated forearms. The ribcage was banded straps of thick, knobby bone spurred all around with sharp points. The skull, was it a skull? A huge knobble of brain pan. Two great green lights foamed within the darkness there, like eyes. It had way too many legs, and a spine like a load-bearing pillar, and it had to crouch forward on two of its heavy-set arms, fledged all over with tibial spines. The exterior arms were thrust back high, and she could see now that they did not have hands, just long, slender blades, each formed from a sharpened radius, held at the ready like a scorpion's tail. It rampaged forward. Harrow's skeleton patiently waited. The construct fell on it like a hot meal, and it disintegrated under the second blow.
You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief, episode 14. I want to fight it.
This is, I think, a really strong place where we're really starting to see a change of pace in the book.
Yes, sir.
They are now much more focused now that they have a place, a thought, an approach, and they're now thinking with two minds. Harrow hasn't yet realized this, really, but the problem solving changes.
Gideon is starting to win a little more. She wins the breakfast argument, but loses the dragging her ass out to go hunt constructs first thing in the morning argument. They're starting to find a little bit more of a balance of power.
Yeah. We have one other character noted in this chapter besides Gideon and Harrow, very briefly.
The repellent third twin.
Of course, the repellent one rather than the resplendent one. I'm trying to figure out exactly where this might have happened. I'm not clear on that. It's near the hatch to the labs, I presume, given that it's mentioned like right before they drop in.
Mm-hmm. I didn't place it very specifically, just sort of in a hallway question mark.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm saying this correctly because I've never heard it said, but etiolated is a lovely word.
Etiolated. Etiolated. Hmm?
It means pale. It is usually said of plants. It's, you know, when plants get all wan for lack of light.
Yeah.
But Iante is described this way. I never see this word. It was exciting.
It seems to me parallel with the pale kids from the Recess cartoon, the like children who never like went outside for recess, and so they had a very different complexion. Iante never went outside to play. But then they're there. And Hera is taking great pains to try and come to some conclusion here, but has not. A lot of this is like descriptive detail of this new space. And I am now hearing a lot of these a second time being like, I wonder if someone's written like, you know, a 10,000 year ago fic of the last time someone was like in this space.
I would be interested in that.
Right? Yeah.
I found on reading this the first several times, I found it really overwhelming, as I know a lot of people do, that there are so many names and so many titles and color coding. And, you know, I was in the fandom for a while before I had what felt like a very natural sort of command of who's who. But I was noticing in this reread, Laboratory 2 is marked with a skull that used to be painted red. And so she's giving us a really strong clue, like this is Second House, this is Gideon Prime and Pyrrha.
Right, right. Yeah, these details are so in some ways generous to us because there's a lot of it there. So we're getting to really see the curiosity of Gideon Prime and Pyrrha.
I'm really curious as well about the discolored walls where a lot of things must have been tacked up and had since been taken down. And I wonder if that's part of Kithareya's sanitization.
Yeah, I mean it's ransacked is a pretty striking choice of word. It really implies a certain type of interference and stripping away in a hurry as well. Like you don't ransack something leisurely. So, you know, the two likelihoods are either this space was evacuated under an emergency condition, or someone came in here with very little time to make a lot of things disappear. Assuming that it is Kithraea's interference, which is the simplest explanation, it's interesting she doesn't really care about covering her tracks. She just wants to cover like the relevant lictoral documents and research and the identities of who was doing it.
I wonder if what had been in that room prior to its being ransacked would have made the test a lot clearer.
Yeah, because if there's, you know, the clipboard like alludes to notes. The books allude to like references to the various, you know, schools of necromantic theorems that might have been part of the multiple theorems that are part of this construct. Like reference materials to those would have made absolute sense.
I'm thinking about like what is on the walls of a standard lab, and you know, it's the periodic table, it's safety advising, it's just reference thing, it's a poster of the Krebs cycle, you know, like it's stuff that you won't remember, but you'll need to reference all the time. And it would be I would pay dollars to have art prints of the sorts of in-world posters that would go on a necromantic lab. I would get that in my office tomorrow.
And I don't, you know, I also think of like how long these spaces were in use for while they were in active use. Because like the amount to which, you know, the walls are populated with those things, a wall that has multiple distinct places where something like that would have been featured would be a lab that was intended for a fairly significant duration of use.
It seems like John and the first round lictors were here for up to 1,000 years, with some less for like the lictors who came a little bit after, like Kithareya. But you know, that goes back to how much can we trust John?
Yeah, how much can we trust John? You know, what was his thought process when he left Kanan House? You know, did he think that he would be having to protect or restore knowledge or cover it up? Like the idea that it got ransacked, motivated by anything other than sabotage, is like what? Why else?
I didn't think about it on first read. I just was like, oh, okay, it's like sort of abandoned and creepy down here, you know? Like it just didn't ping as a needing explanation. It was very just like fallout.
But, you know, like Fallout, like Bethesda does an enormous amount of environmental storytelling through the details of what is and isn't there when you stop and take a notice of it, like talking about the posters. We're also noticing that, like, the action happens not in this room, but in a room that this one controls.
Yeah, so Gideon is, now that she's in the facility, but not urgently motivated by Harrow's safety, not that she cares about Harrow's safety anyway,
No,
she's
not at all.
starting to really take in the details of, you know, what's missing from the walls. And she's, you know, touching this disintegrating paper and finding it yucky. But she's also noticing immediately that this place is absolutely covered in Harrow's blood.
The handprints from the last time Harrow was here and needed a bit of a nap. So we get a bit of information. It's like something like 90 kilograms worth of bones that she put into this so far, which, you know, there's some math between how small the bone chip is and how big of a thing she can just generate, you know, like bone material from. And then the implication that the further she stretches that, the more of a tax it is on her body and the energy moving through her body. And then we get blood sweats. So this is also, we were talking before about like where the blood sweat would be. Like we have this, nose as really prominently featured. This now has handprints, which is a new thing for us in terms of seeing Harrow's blood sweat.
Yeah, it seems like she's interacting with her face and then touching stuff because it doesn't seem like there's been any evidence that she sweats blood from her hands.
Or she's specifically like bleeding herself and then using it like some kind of finger paint.
That seems more bloodworthy. I think she
It
doesn't get into
does.
that until later.
Yeah.
So
So
we've
she's
got.
just wiping it away from her face and then hands on the walls.
Yeah, and I wonder why she's doing that, because that doesn't seem. I would think that she would be paranoid about getting her biomaterial just where anybody could interact with it.
Yeah.
But she's also a goblin who doesn't keep herself clean, so.
And one thing that is kind of like a varying element is her attention to certain external details reduce the more she's getting obsessive about one thing.
That's super real. That's true.
So if it's a striking detail that she's left, biomatter, like it shows how obsessed she got about this to the point where she's not thinking about the competition anymore.
So the basic mechanics of this test, you've got the imaging door and the response door. So the necromancer is in this room where they've got their hand locked into a pillar, and that opens the door and sets off the giant construct monster that the Cavalier can then fight, but they can't see into the test except through the Cavalier.
I think it would be more about them seeing through the Cavalier than the construct. Big bone monsters aren't a really big part of Lictorhood, but an intimate interaction with, the body of your Cavalier is.
I mean, all of these challenges are meant to teach part of what it takes to become a lictor. And part of it is being together in one body.
Team building exercises.
And this, yes, team building. So, this is the first opportunity that they have to share a body. And it's interesting that they're sharing Gideon's body.
Yeah, they don't have any preconceived notion over how a lictor should be shaped. They don't really have that piece of information. So they're just kind of going with what makes the most sense, which is put the person with the sword in the room because they're less likely to get murdered by the bone monster. Sure. And also physically, the necromancer can't. So Gideon goes in there and, initially watches this monster. I think one of the interesting things there too is it's like awareness of her. Like, does this bone construct have any persistent awareness?
Yeah, because this it forms sort of out of a mist, and then once the exercise is terminated, it immediately goes to pieces and schlorps down a drain.
Yeah, and it really, really dials that it's not like chips. It turns into like, it specifically chooses the word soup. It specifically chooses the word soup, which is a choice.
I certainly hope that this guy doesn't have. I hope this monster doesn't have sapience. I was curious about the green eyes and what meaning that might have, because as far as I could recall, all of the eyes of the skeletons so far were red.
So then we have one that is distinctly unlike any of the constructs we've seen so far.
And not a house reference, because the house reference would be red.
There's something in the way that it looks at Gideon that to me wants to suggest a higher level of awareness. But whether or not that's a persistent awareness is not clear. If it does turn to soup, but like, I don't know about necromancy.
Yeah. This is another case we discussed on some previous episode that there would be a case in the future where Gideon sort of unlocks a puzzle, and she does it here as well. This wasn't the case we were discussing, but Gideon is the one who's like, I need to be in that room. It's not just more and more and more skeletons.
Yeah.
It has to be me. And she doesn't have a good justification. Her justification is, it looks like swords and I want to fight it. But she's having this instinct that she's like, I need to be the one who's in there. And this, it doesn't seem like it's coming from that energy of just like pent up, sort of anxious, wanting to fight. She does feel like she's focused up here.
Yeah, she's dedicated to solving this puzzle. And she's like, this is what I can contribute. And it does, you know, she's gone through this first approach of using her perfectly fine eye jelly to watch it. And that is not enough information to solve this puzzle. And she's like, get me in there. I think there's a little bit of applying herself to the pursuit and research of Lictor. Like, this is the first time Gideon has really gotten hands-on in this research.
Mm-hmm.
So this is also kind of pivoting her relationship to this whole project. You know, she is like not just convincing Hera to let her participate. She is modifying Hera's approach because she can do a thing that Hera can't. And she's like, we need more information. Also, I want to fight it.
They run this scenario over and over and over before Gideon actually just runs on in there. Mm-hmm. And Hera is getting chewed up and just doesn't care.
Yeah. So we've got at least 5 times by reference.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, again, following. I do wonder, like, how Hera measures her stamina.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's fine with collapsing into a nap. It makes me wonder how she has knowledge of pushing herself before.
Yeah, because it seems like between this chapter and the bone in the basement, she and the library, she's just in the habit of working until she physically cannot and her body gives out.
Yes. Yeah. Which, you know, is a variable. She's just coming off of doing so. Her body hasn't really had time to fully recover by most bodies' needs standards. And she's already been working at this. Just after, you know, it talks about her, like, pushing, you know, 20 skeletons on the floor, blood rings around her nose. She's talking about her parents and her grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
First reference of grandma.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly grandma was a big deal necro. And to me, that speaks to like direct instruction from them, like a direct or at least a very specific understanding of what their capacity and approach would have been in this situation. Because she does recognize that it's not the one that she's using. She's surpassed them.
It's so hard to know how seriously to take that, because that is the sort of thing that a 17-year-old often believes. But she is also magic.
Yeah. Yeah. How much is this about the magic and how much is this about being a teenager?
Yeah. Because the thing is, she is very good. Gideon can tell that she can do things that not everybody can do. But she is also just keeping up with Palamedes, who wasn't made through magic genocide. So it made her a necromancer, but like, I don't know. She's very good, but I don't know if she's better than very good.
Sure, yeah. The idea that they did a magic genocide to get a magic necro baby, and that was like an honestly pretty average necro baby, like just because that's the base cost of doing that, like is a little like both climactic and anticlimactic in the same moment.
I mean, that's her nightmare, right?
The fact that she might be average. Oh God, Hera could never. I'm imagining her at one point with like her robes held up like a little apron with just like, you know, when kids like use their shirt to like collect raspberries or something. I'm just seeing Hera with her robes like just overfilling, like just kind of tottering along, trying to dump more bone matter into that room. And I know that's not exactly how that goes, but like, it's close. As Gideon first steps into this room, because like it's this thing where Gideon's like, and like sitting there watching and pacing, like seeing the skeletons go through, and just like kind of fuck it.
So we get moisture. You commented previously that it's oddly dry here, given that it's coastal.
Yeah.
But it's wet in here and it smells stale. There's this sort of chemical process of releasing what becomes this bone construct.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's like the stale of a slightly moist, long forgotten environment, like dusty, but kind of wet.
Well, it comes out of, there's fog being piped into the room, and the fog seems to sort of create this construct that then supifies.
And so we don't previously have any example of necromancy with fog.
Uh-oh.
It's not just like steam. So I'm trying to like figure out what would be in that air. Like bone mist? Like what would bone, like is bone mist a thing?
I mean, there's bone dust, but that's not wet.
It's not wet.
Yeah, I think this doesn't have a clear parallel in reality.
Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong, but I think that this is just like straight up magic stuff.
Yeah, it's just like some theater. The magic theater.
It's cool as hell. I don't know.
And also, like, you know, there's going to be like that, like a bit of a sound, and it's going to be a little bit, like sound distinctly different from all these spaces, because like this is sound transfers moves differently through different humidities of air. Like even the way that the sound moves in the room is going to be different. But apparently there's no time to notice the sound because it comes up pretty quickly. It just kind of emerges out of it. From the bottom, it says rising. So it's, you know, it's on the ground and slowly constructing itself.
As an aside, I have looked up how heavy is an average person's skeleton, and the AI overview tells me that it's approximately 10 to 12 kilograms or 2,226 pounds, which is not correct.
That's some terrible math.
That's not correct. I appreciate that she notes that the osseous matter by itself is much lighter and less capable of landing a heavy blow than an actual human with muscles, because this is, of course, one of the things that makes it unbelievable for a bunch of skeletons to beat up Gideon Nav, because a regular human-sized skeleton is about 20 pounds. And of course, without musculature, it can't move anyway, but we're giving it magic for that. But shit, yeah. Bone isn't that heavy.
Yeah, the things that continue to make bone heavy are the like water and fat and like marrow tissues that are inside of it. Like there's goo and watery stuff. And even that doesn't stack up a lot because the volume is not enormous.
Yeah.
But still, a rapier is not the right tool for this situation in such a big way.
Totally.
That like, I'm almost surprised it's not noted, Gideon, like, reflecting on some frustration around that. Like I know that she eventually pivots and starts to use her longsword in this test later on the road.
She does, though, doesn't she? Yeah, she said, actually in conversation with the weight, the good news is it, you know, it can't land a heavy blow on her. The bad news is she can't do jack shit to it. Her light sword could barely deflect the blows. She had some small hope with her knuckle knives. So,
she can
do nothing with a rapier. A rapier is going to do great damage to flesh, but it's simply not going to break bone.
Yeah, it's for poking holes in meat.
Exactly.
It's for poking holes in meat. And so then I think about the other cavaliers. Like, if they were historically using rapiers, or if they are presently using rapiers to also do this lab, like, how are they overcoming it? It is almost hilariously positioned to be frustrating because of this weird necessity that they only use rapiers.
It's possible that the idea that a cavalier almost only uses a rapier is sort of a new thing. And or that it's sort of a ceremonial thing, and it wouldn't occur to them that a cavalier would take a rapier into a lab situation, that that's sort of a parade instrument and not in the same way that, you know, the U.S. Marine Corps has, I think, sabers, but it's for show. They don't expect them to fight with them.
Yeah. Very, yeah, it's accessorizing a uniform.
Yeah, because I'm thinking of Gideon Prime, and he fights with a spear, right?
I don't know.
I think he fights with a spear.
Now, when is the moment that Harrow starts, you know, hanging out in Gideon's body? Like, because it talks about two moments where she kind of, like, reels in her body. Like, one when she first steps in, and another a little bit further down, where it talks about, like, something at the very corners of her vision, like, in her gaze, slides into place. And immediately Harrow's like, okay.
I think the place where Harrow first gets into Gideon is right at the beginning, in the same paragraph as the fog with the stale smelling stuff in the cloud. From imaging, Harrow grunted explosively, which nearly got her cavalier knocked ass over tits. I think that was the first moment where Harrow makes contact with Gideon's consciousness and is absolutely overwhelmed by it, because she says it takes her several minutes just to sort of sort through the feedback that she's getting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then she kind of gets to stop thinking. And then she's got that sort of weird, which she describes as the peripheral mirage, where Gideon is starting to sense Harrow's presence. I think that doesn't happen until Harrow has started to sort of get a handle on things.
So what we're seeing a lot of her, like, noises as she's going is her kind of wrestling through those layers and trying to get inside Gideon. And, you know, as we talked about earlier, like, this test is not about the bone construct. And this, you know, is the struggle of our characters for this chapter. This is the thing. It's their relating to each other that is the messy part. Like, there's a mystery of bones, but, like, this is where we get into them not really knowing where they are, what's happening. Before it was like, oh, okay, fight the bones. Now they're
wild,
like,
that Iante figured this out without even observing it.
Unless she's already been doing it with Corona.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
Which makes me feel even more weird and skeezy about...
They have bad boundaries.
They have bad boundaries. But it's interesting because, you know, there's certain, like, violations of necromantic norms that we're starting to see here as, like, little edges that these individual groupings have that they, you know, weren't expected to have. It's unique out of their life circumstances. But has given them their own unique edge.
Harrow, with difficulty, starts to actually be able to make sense of visual input through Gideon's eyes.
Yeah.
And Gideon is being surprisingly cooperative with Harrow's instructions, despite the fact that she's literally in the middle of a fight.
To the point of, like, extremely specific things, like, close an eye. And which sounds to me like Harrow trying to, like, manage data, like, information and sensory input.
That's how I took it too.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. That she was having trouble with binocular vision, and she's like, just simplify this for me.
Yeah, yeah. When she kind of attempts to wrest control back, it's not, she can't readily do so. But she's in the moment of the fight and doesn't really have a chance to reflect on that. It's just noted. But, you know, her fighting following that does feel somewhat impaired.
Yeah, she already wasn't doing great in this fight. And this is her first encounter, I think, with regenerating bone, which comes up a number of times with the lictors have this trick. I'm curious about sort of if this is another case of two theorems being knit together, where the regenerating is being knit with something else. And I'm like, what is the something else that's doing the soup trick? Like,
yeah.
What are the theorems that go into making this weird guy?
And so, like, if bones are drier, because the bones that are being generated are not full of the wet people parts, but just bony bones, the moisture is definitely enabling the, like, flushing to occur in a way that might have been more difficult without it. They're just, like, just making a real wet skeleton for the sake of cleaning up.
And because necromancers lived bad lives.
We were not good people. But yeah, Gideon kind of gets a bit kicked. And then it kind of finally occurs to Hera what this is about. And I think this is probably a really powerful moment for Hera to realize how much she needs Gideon as part of this process. Like, this, she couldn't have done this test without Gideon here. Mm-hmm. Gideon is an integral part of this test.
And not just as a lab assistant who can look through a window for her.
Yeah, yeah. Both of their selves are integral parts of this test. And the relationship between their selves is the point. And I do find that fascinating of, like, what dropping into, you know, a living person, a living spirit still attached to a nervous system. We're having some discrete elements of our necromancy now being described. Like, a nervous system is separate from the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Which to me would imply that both of them could exist separate from each other under artificial means or unknown natural means. So we're starting to get a little bit more information about more advanced necromancy as well.
The comparison that Hera draws between the pain that she feels when being in Gideon in this way and skeleton feedback indicates pretty clearly to me that it is always painful to operate the skeletons.
Mm.
It's not just blood sweat. It's not just sort of exhaustion. It is physically painful the whole time.
I was watching a video talking about werewolves the other day where basically, like, the cellular division necessary for body modification at that pace and speed, like, the caloric requirements for that amount of cell division is insane. And the, like, physical accommodations that pre-existing muscles and bones would have to do to shapeshift a human being into a werewolf, also very painful. So is this painful for Hera because of the experience of channeling and directing Thanergy? Or is it that, like, she is using, like, her body's energy? Like, this is a physical exertion.
It seems like it's a stimulation thing. Like, a harsh noise is painful.
Mm-hmm.
But it's much worse with a real person versus a skeleton.
Yeah.
I worry that this means that it hurts for the Cavaliers the whole time.
Within the lictors?
Yeah.
But this hasn't caused Gideon... Well, interesting.
Gideon has a really fucked up relationship with pain anyway.
Yeah.
She wouldn't necessarily tell us if she was in pain. She doesn't usually. She says here, like, oh, I thought my shoulder might be dislocated. No big. She's not like, ah, it hurt really bad when I dislocated my shoulder. Like, she doesn't care that she's in pain either.
Yeah. She's like, maybe, but let's keep going.
Yeah. So we would, in order to know the answer to that question, we would have to see the POV of a Cavalier who wasn't already neutral towards pain.
Yeah. With all these different relationships between necros and calves in the current grouping, you know, they're doing it under certain circumstances. Their relationships to each other have been constructed out of tradition as much as preparation for lictorial pursuits. And so, you know, I step back and I question the original pairings. Like, those relationships seemed a lot more of, they were opted in pairings. They were people who chose to partner together.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to a lot of these ones, which
they were, like, assigned.
Yeah. And the pairings that we do get that are very, like, complementary and compatible and interested and willing and engaged with each other, like, you know, either get killed off really quickly or develop their own relationship with the potential that these necromantic theorems offer.
Hashtag Paul.
Hashtag Paul. Because you know, immediately upon discovering that Harrow's pain and discomfort has come from being inside her actual brain and in her nervous system, Dean's be like, fuck the fuck off.
Yeah, she does not like that.
She's immediately like, you don't get more of me.
Absolute hard limit. You cannot go in there.
Nope. A big nope. But I think in that moment, you know, Harrow probably realizes that engaging with Gideon this way, accessing Gideon this way, is the point. So like, her not doing so will be something that Harrow will have to deal with down the road, I imagine. She's like, okay, fine, I figured out how to do it. You're not interested in right now, but that's a later problem.
Yeah.
Because Harrow doesn't really push back against those boundaries, but it only like just set like doesn't so much push back against the boundaries as like say, oh, it's not as big of a deal as you think. Like, it's not, I'm not in your head.
Yeah. The pushback here, and I will try to restrain myself from pulling everything back to my dissertation for the whole rest of this show, but there's a management of the objection that I see in eugenicists in like the middle 20th century, where people are like, we're worried that they're going to try to make some sort of superhuman race. And the eugenicists are like, don't be silly. We won't know how to do that for decades. And the management is, we don't know how to do that, which is different from we don't want to do that. Or like, you are wrong about the basic idea of, it's like, we don't know how to do that. And I see Harrow doing that same thing. She's like, I don't know how to do that. I wish I could, but I don't. So you don't even need to worry about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, she does talk about like, she doesn't have the desire. So that there's kind of a like, you're gross and I don't want to be inside your brain. I hate you.
But she also does, like, she also does.
She does, because, like, what she wants is the power, the control, the development forward in pursuit of Lictorhood. Like,
this when Gideon first says, you can read my thoughts, she says, no, not remotely, if only I could. And then she says, I don't want you in my brain. And she says, don't have an aneurysm. I cannot and will not read your thoughts. I certainly don't have the desire. She just said she did. She just said, if only I could do that. And then she's like, ugh, you're being so dramatic. I don't even want to.
And we've talked before about how Harrow is not very inclined to using deceptive language, but here she really does turn on a dime to try and, you know, so I guess I'm quite wrong in terms of the pushback. Like, she doesn't explicitly be like, I didn't do this, I didn't do that. She's more reducing her role, reducing Gideon's perception of her power, being like, I'm just a little guy in there. I'm just a little guy.
It's possible also that she's drawing a distinction between read your thoughts in terms of make sense of your current brain activity versus what Gideon seems to be worried about, which is like memories, like inner life.
Yeah.
And so maybe she's telling the truth and that she's saying like, yeah, I wish I could get a handle on what's going on right now, but like, I'm not trying to read your diary. Weird.
Yeah. 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 Because she does, you know, initially respond after talking about engaging with the nervous system, this first kind of denial.
I think that goes back to the struggle over Gideon's humanity that shaped their initial conflict, where Harrow is like, you might be of utility. And Gideon's like, no, I'm a person. And she's like, ew, no, I don't want any of that. That's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that is consistent with that. We talk about how Gideon's relationship to Harrow's relationship to Gideon depends on whether it's being perceived. This is now kind of like a third state. So we're seeing another kind of relationship here. And this is negotiation and navigation of finding that space, because Gideon is insisting quite emphatically of her whole personhood and her right to define who gets to access what parts of her personhood.
Yeah, and we've seen her before. She's really, really protective of things that are hers, and she really resents Harrow for thinking of all of her things as Harrow's things by transitive property.
Yeah.
Like, she she's really protective about owning the key ring because it was given to her, and she doesn't probably own anything
besides her sword, really.
Which, is that even really hers? Like,
I don't know. It depends on how you look at it. If it's cursed, does that change things?
I wasn't even thinking of the whole there's a soul inside it thing. I just meant, like, probably it was, like, given to her by the house, but the house owns her and it owns all her stuff.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So they get through it. They debrief a little bit. They negotiate a little bit about boundaries. Harrow hasn't really given up this task, but hits the wall. We see Harrow exactly at that point where we've, you know, seen her before, where she works until her body can no longer hold her and she collapses. Just comedically.
Yeah, I love this last little paragraph. And she crumpled neatly back onto the floor. Pure sentiment found Gideon kicking out one leg to catch her. She ended up lightly punting her necromancer on the shoulder, but assumed that it was the thought that counted.
That must have felt so nice for Gideon. Just like warm, fuzzy little feeling.
She helped. She's the helpiest.
The moments where she has control over Harrow's body are really interesting to me because she doesn't do a lot in those moments. She's kind of at odds. She does not want to reciprocate the kinds of abuses to Harrow that she has received.
Uh-huh.
She doesn't see that as a kind of, you know, balance or justice or revenge. Like,
she fantasizes about it, but when given the opportunity, she doesn't actually do it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like she does it just to, like, symbolically say that she did.
So presumably during this floor nap, Harrow is just lying there recovering and Gideon is standing watch over her.
Just Gideon just doing, like, push-ups.
Probably. I'm just imagining if the sixth had walked in and Harrow's just passed out on the ground and Gideon's just, like, doing pull-ups on a random door frame. Just, like, everything's normal here. This is all normal.
I feel like the sixth wouldn't even really blink. They'd be like,
at least she's here.
Yeah, okay, sure. The ninth is weird, but okay. I'm sure Palamedes would have some comment as to Harrow's health.
I got next on that bone machine.
I would love to hear how Harrow would debrief with Camilla about what's in there. There's not nearly enough, like, collaborative tactical conversations in these books. For having such what are presented as brilliant fighters, they don't talk about fighting with each other. Which, like, having been around other fighters, like, we're giant nerds about what we do. Just the fact that they don't talk to each other about fighting, I think, is more... Mirror's writing focuses on the necromancy in these books, for sure. Because when, you know, there's, like, lesbian necromancers in space, and then I add my little asterisks with swords, I'm just like, can I just want, like, the, like, Camilla and Gideon comparing, like, tactical strategies to fight the bone construct while, like, you know, Harrow is napping and Palamedes is kind of, like, observing the scenario, trying to get as much information as possible is very plausible. And, like,
totally.
Would be fun.
I will say it would be very hard for someone to write a scene like that well who didn't have your level of depth of knowledge of sword fighting.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because it's not even just experience.
Yeah.
It's like you were trained by nerds. I was trained by jocks. It was a very different experience.
Yeah, that's fair. At every moment where I have one of these things, I'm just like, I gotta go check out AO3. Like I need an AO3 fix to fulfill my imagination's requirements here.
Yeah. Venpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Cayley and edited by Han Cayley. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Today's cover art is from Holland. You can find us at nunpod.com, that's nunpod.com, or get our attention online with the hashtag nunpod. Thanks for listening.